Whether you're driving locally or taking interstates across Illinois, chances are you're going to hit some construction. Now, with the government allocating more money and implementing regular maintenance, the construction might never stop, but is this a better solution?
You're going to see a lot of cracking. It's going to be a rougher ride. There'll probably be better chances of potholes, especially in the winter months when we have freeze-thaw cycles.
That's Kevin Burke of the Illinois Asphalt and Pavement Association. He says billions of dollars and new strategy won't make up for years of underfunding. Also, a Southern Illinois shooting instructor who's offering his class to teachers joins us to talk about why they're attending his courses. New research from Northwestern University shows that LGBT teenagers are at a higher risk of developing diabetes. And is the Champaign Public Library doing away with overdue book fines? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, we're going to be talking about the state of our roads and bridges. Are we doing enough to maintain them? How much of a priority is that for you? Those of you taxpayers who are listening, if you have thoughts, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about that soon. Also, later in the hour, we're going to be speaking with a researcher from Northwestern University who's looking at LGBTQ teenagers and the higher health risks they have. But first, on Monday, we talked about how Governor Rauner signed a new law that would allow police to take guns away from those deemed by courts to pose a threat. He also extended the 72-hour gun purchase waiting period on all firearms. He did say he would veto a measure adding licensing requirements for gun stores. The bills that Governor Rauner signed had the support of the State Rifle Association. But still, as others are pushing for stronger gun control, those who oppose gun control are pushing back. We've reported in the past on some places declaring themselves sanctuary counties for guns. And even though the legal implications of that are not clear, at least 25 counties in Illinois have passed resolutions that declare themselves, quote, sanctuary counties for gun owners. Although Illinois is one of 40 states that prohibit concealed weapons in schools, a wave of teachers and administrators across the state are enrolling in concealed carry classes. In fact, many instructors are offering classes for free or at a discounted rate for teachers. And to be clear, though, Illinois does prohibit concealed weapons in schools. On the line with me now are several Illinois concealed carry instructors. Mark Jens is an instructor at Concealed Carry Safety for Personal Defense, Inc. in Niles. That's a northwest suburb of Chicago. He's also retired from the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department and was also a police academy instructor. Mark, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good morning. Thanks for being with me. Tom Dorsch is also on the line with us. He's the director of On Target Range and Tactical Training in Crystal Lake, also in the Chicago suburbs. Tom, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you, Nyla.
Tom, good morning. Tom, I understand you had a concealed carry class that you offered yesterday?
Yes. We had the two-day concealed carry class for 24 teachers. They're offered a summer, so it's good timing for them to come on in. And they enjoyed it, and I think they took home a lot of useful information, even if they're not ever going to be able to carry in this school. So I don't consider it a waste of time. And another thing that I tell them, the first thing I tell them, I said, listen, the most important thing that you're going to learn in this class doesn't come from me. It comes from you. After you go through this, and we take them on the range a couple times, and we do a lot of extensive holster drills, and to get them into the realm of concealed carrying, what it's like, and you're going to have to make that decision. Do you have the right mindset to do this? And if so, then your training really starts. We're not advocating at all that all teachers should be armed, so I want to put that up front.
And Tom, you mentioned mindset. I wonder if you could speak to, I should mention, we reached out to quite a few superintendents and teachers who expressed an interest in this, but they weren't comfortable saying this publicly on our program. So I wanted to ask you, what are you hearing from teachers who are coming to your classes, Tom? What are they telling you about why they're coming?
They all want to be able to protect their kids, every one of them. And there's a couple of them who are a little bit more emphatic about it. Others are more curious, but they all have that common denominator. They want to do something. Whether or not it's legalized or not, they want to at least get the training behind them. And that way, It's sending a loud message to the school administrators throughout the state that there are a number of concerned teachers who don't want to just sit on their hands and hope for the best. They want to actively start doing something now.
We've got Mark Magus with us as well, who's another concealed carry instructor. He's the owner of Trigger Talent in Godfrey, Illinois, that's near St. Louis. Hi, Mark. Thanks for being with us here with us as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And now I know back in April, you also offered a free concealed carry class specifically for teachers. How many people attended that?
It was 40, which is the maximum size, and it sold out in 2 hours.
So it sounds like there was a lot of interest in Godfrey for this.
There was actually the whole Godfrey, the east side of Illinois, next to St. Louis. They came from all over.
And we were just hearing Tom say that teachers understand this isn't something they can do now. They want to feel prepared. What are you hearing from the teachers who signed up for your class, Mark?
That they would like to carry. It's a real long shot for the state of Illinois. But, you know, anything is possible with the current administration. So we're hoping, and they are hoping, that unless the schools get hardened, which is not likely to happen due to budget constraints, that they'll be able to, it comes down to prepare themselves for workplace violence.
I want to come back to the issue of hardening in a minute, but Mark Jens, I wanted to bring you into the conversation. Have you offered these classes in Niles for teachers?
Yes, we have, ma'am, and we have unfortunately found that the teachers that are looking to do it for free value it about as much as they pay for it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the ones that we did offer to do it for free did not seem to take the class seriously. When we withdrew the offer and people had to pay for it, they took it seriously.
Okay. And so what are you, and when the ones who took it seriously, what kinds of things were they telling you, Mark Jens?
Well, we had the same as the other folks had, and thank you for letting me exchange with my esteemed colleagues. They were looking for a way to mostly be able to protect themselves and have the tool to be able to protect their others if the need arises and they chose to do so. I think that what we're seeing in Illinois is a change in an attitude, and I don't think that the concealed carry law, which specifically prohibits licensees from carrying on school grounds, will change. What I think another resource is, and I've discussed this with several lawmakers and chief law enforcement officers in the area, being former law enforcement myself, that we have a huge pool of qualified retired police officers, people that are so-called battle-hardened. They've been out there doing the job 20, 30 years, that would be more than willing to augment income and come in and serve as a school resource officer at a much reduced rate than it would take to get a full-time police officer with full benefits, and they're doing it. So it's another idea. The biggest problem with all of this is, Wayne LaPierre from the NRA says it best, sometimes the only thing that'll stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, but the good guy with the gun's got to be there. And schools are big places. They can't be everywhere all the time.
So, Mark Jens, it sounds like you would be in favor of, as someone, a former Cook County Sheriff's Office police officer, correct? And I know you also were a police academy instructor. It sounds like you're saying that there are a lot of retired police officers out there who could also serve as resource officers for schools to this kind of this idea of hardening. Maybe is this would be your preference for hardening schools this way?
I think a combination has to take place where there's limited access from the multiple doors that are there, and then the doors that do allow open access to the public have someone there that if we have someone come in looking to do harm, they're met with resistance. And we find that in Illinois, and we've been doing this since 2013, that the places that display the placard, whether they're statutorily required or do so under private property doctrine, tend to be viewed as soft targets by criminals because they feel that lawful concealed carry ID persons will not be in there to protect themselves. Criminals are lazy. They look for a good way to get in and do what they want to do and get out.
We're talking to three concealed carry instructors from all across Illinois. That's Mark Jens. He teaches in Niles. Tom Dorsch was on the line with us from Crystal Lake. Mark Magus is with us as well from Godfrey, all the way down near St. Louis. Mark Magus, as I think there are people who are listening, and we've also heard on this program, I've had teachers, I've had school superintendents, and honestly, most of the students who have been on this program who say they're terrified by the idea of having teachers carry guns. And I wonder what you would say to people who say they're very scared that this will make things worse.
Well, you know, that's and I've heard that also. And what these people are, I think, unaware of, in Madison County alone, I mean, it's a large county. We have 24,000 concealed carriers now, and these people are around concealed carriers all day long, every day, and don't even know it. And that's how it's supposed to be. And the same thing would be in a school. If these teachers, these select, and I will say select few, because if I had to guess from all the teachers I've trained, I mean, hundreds, that there are few that would really be mentally prepared or even qualified to carry a gun in a school. And most of them will actually admit that also. So if these people, if these select teachers or administrators are trained the way they should be, which by the way, is far past the 16-hour course mandated by the state, then I think that would alleviate most of those fears.
Tom, do you agree?
Well, I agree with definitely the select few. And that comes back to, you know, the training, the extra training they're going to have to go through as well. But I want to add this, that there's a big misconception that we're saying, well, teachers are going to be packing their firearms on their hips in classes and frightening children. Okay, that's not the way I see it at all. I'd say there should be a secure location that a teacher would have access. I mean, could you imagine in a school where there's a fight between kids and a firearm pops out on the floor? No, that we don't want that. So I want to get that off the table. That's not what we're saying either. So I definitely, you know, we're looking at different options and how they can have something there, but in easy visibility, something out of the way where people don't even know they're there, and the kids shouldn't even know they're there. They don't even know what teachers are carrying, where it might be stored or anything. Now, just by the whole movement of teachers coming out and it reaching the airwaves of TV and radio, what we're hoping, and I'm sure the other gentlemen will agree, is that the word trickles down to the would-be attackers and let them think that all teachers are armed and maybe they won't even try it. Times are changing. Hey, maybe it's not a time to go into a school anymore when you look at the possibility of having someone actually shoot back at you.
Mark, Jens, I wanted to ask you about what Tom and Mark Magus are alluding to, which is, and you said this at the beginning, you feel like there's almost a cultural shift. Can you explain a little bit more about what you're seeing as well?
Well, the teachers that we've spoken to, and we, in a recent class, had six young ladies in here, and again, during the summer, it's convenient, and spoke to the idea of, and I actually have them come back in afterwards, and we speak with them. Is it a good idea for you to carry a firearm in school? Do you feel prepared? And universally, the answer was no, and I hardly agree with that. I think the law could be changed that certain teachers that have undergone additional tactical training. When I taught at the police academy, police recruits weren't even beginning to get their tactical training until after 40 hours of basic firearms and law. Those select persons have a background check done, perhaps a psychological, and having their firearms to hand when the emergency arises is when, I have to respectfully disagree with our colleague, a central location, because that's when seconds count, the guns are only minutes away. Properly concealed and proper training to be able to tactically retain that firearm. One of the classes we teach here, weapon retention, based on my police academy experience, would be essential so that the gun doesn't wind up popping out on the floor or being taken from them. So they would have to voluntarily undergo additional training. Perhaps the school districts could offer a stipend in a form of a salary that they, by taking this on to themselves, they may be able to. In my opinion, be probably cheaper than trying to have a full-time police school resource officer present at all times.
We've certainly heard a variety of opinions here among you three gentlemen, three concealed carry instructors in Illinois. Mark Magus, what else would you like to see? What measures would you like to see taken to protect students in our schools?
To me, the hardening of the school is paramount. And if that happens, then we would need maybe one officer, one armed officer, one gun in school. That would be ideal. So we have to have the limited access. I'm not opposed to metal detectors. Whatever it takes to keep these people out of the school, I think that's also the cheapest way, the most cost-effective. So I think if we achieve that, then we won't need to arm teachers. We won't need to pay for that additional training, additional salaries. I think the reality is the taxpayers are unwilling to do that. So I eventually think it's going to fall on armed teachers to be there when it happens to stop it.
And what do you think about, for example, all the discussion about mental health measures and those sorts of things?
I think it's a fair assessment. I mean, as far as the teachers go.
No, as far as just keeping an eye out for students who may be, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about students and mental health issues and preventative measures for students who may want to bring a gun to school.
I'm all for that. I mean, these guys that started it in Columbine, those guys were obviously wackos. That guy at Lakeland, Florida, telegraphed, I don't know, what, for 3 or 4 years that this guy was a potential mass shooter and a mass murderer. There's this big fear of lawsuits in this country. You know, if you rat on somebody, then they can come back and sue you, which is probably the reality, which is also part of the problem. I mean, we have to find these nutcases before they go hot.
We're going to take a break when we come back. Yeah, we'll give you a chance to wrap up with your thoughts. Gentlemen, if you can stay with me for just we'll take a quick break for 2 minutes. On the other side of that, I'll let you all wrap up your thoughts on that as we talk to concealed carry instructors across Illinois about the teachers who have been showing up in their classes this summer. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Although Illinois is one of 40 states that prohibit concealed weapons in schools, that hasn't stopped hundreds of teachers, especially this summer, from enrolling in concealed carry classes across Illinois. We're talking to three instructors for these courses. Mark Magus is the owner of Trigger Talent in Godfrey, that's close to St. Louis. Mark Jones is with us from Concealed Carry Safety for Personal Defense, Inc. in Niles, in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. Tom Dorsch is with us as well from Crystal Lake, where he's the director of On Target Range and the Tactical Training Center. Gentlemen, I just wanted to end. First of all, I think someone was responding to what Mark Magus was saying, and I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that. Go ahead. Okay, so if you didn't have a chance to respond to that, I did want to end by asking you all one question. I think there are people who are listening, and I alluded to this earlier. This is such a visceral issue when we're talking about guns. I think people have very passionate and visceral reactions to how they feel. And I wanted to ask you all how you feel like you need to, if you feel like you need to, bridge the divide between students and families who are very scared about the number of guns in this country and say that having other people defend themselves is not the solution. And I wonder how you would respond to people who feel differently from you all. Mark Jones, can I start with you?
Yes, ma'am. Well, I think the underlying causes being sociological in nature need to be addressed before the problem itself is going to ameliorate. As far as the fear of the guns, I kind of get the feeling from a lot of people come in here that it's a generated fear from people that are anti-gun, and they seem to get an awful lot of play in the media, and people don't get the other side of it. I see hundreds of reports every month of law-abiding citizens that have protected themselves with firearms, not always necessarily shooting, but avoided being badly hurt or killed. The issues of the schools, actually the federal law does address it, and I think we've missed that. Federal law prohibits anyone from carrying a firearm onto a school zone. A person knows or has reason to believe it's a school zone unless they are licensed to do so by the state in which in that school zone is located. The Illinois law, of course, trumps that because as a licensee, you're prohibited. Additional legislation that limits it may be the right answer or other. You know what? I don't think there's any one right answer. I think a combination of things have to take place, and a lot of it's going to have to be sociological adjustments to people being able to report dangerous things without fear of retribution.
Certainly this is a complex issue. Mark Magus?
Well, to me, I mean, the Second Amendment is enshrined in our Constitution and our psyche. So guns are hopefully always going to be legal in the United States. What we have to do is keep them out of the hands of bad people, whatever that may evolve into. That has to be paramount. We have to do more rigorous background checks for people that have mental illnesses or problems. So I think the people that are anti-gun, I'd like to just make it so easy that they just need to get it, but I know it's not that simple. But the reality is they do. And then, like it's been said a million times, the only good way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, and he's got to be there right now. And that's why concealed carry has taken off so largely and continues to grow. And now I see the Ninth Court even is swinging towards the literal writing of the Second Amendment, shall not be infringed. So it's a slow process. We're getting it. The American public needs to, that is anti-gun. Just in my opinion, it sounds harsh, but they need to get their mind right. I'm a little tired of it. Just like the previous gentleman said, you rarely hear of the instances where a good guy with a gun saved lives, but you hear about the other side constantly. The media is a big problem.
Tom?
You know, you're never going to change the attitude of the fervent anti-gunners, and but there's a number of people who aren't, they're kind of stuck in the middle. So they're being bombarded by the media on a daily basis of how evil the guns are and how evil gun owners are. But let the facts speak for themselves. Look at how many concealed carry holders we have in this state. Gentlemen, what do we have? Over 200,000 now? 300,000?
We hit 300,000 this year.
Yeah, I believe it's quarter of a million.
Right mm-hmm.
Now, can anyone tell me the last time they heard an incident of a gun falling out at Walmart or wherever it might be? I don't run into that. It's hardly reported. I know the anti-gunners really hate that. They were hoping to see a lot more incidents, but they are few and far between. So that speaks highly of the responsibility of the gun owner. That here are these people who are all vetted.
That did occur.
You're going to carry a gun. You go through the state police background check in order to get your credentials. So I think that the facts alone speak that it tells the whole public that gun owners are not to be feared. They walk among us, and they're totally safe.
I want to thank the three of you for taking the time to speak with me, Mark Magus with Trigger Talent, and Godfrey, Mark Jens, Concealed Carry Safety for Personal Defense, and Niles, and Tom Dorsch, On Target Range and Tactical Training Center in Crystal Lake. Gentlemen, thanks for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. You know the joke about the seasons we have here in Illinois? We have winter and construction. Chances are, no matter what road, interstate, or tollway you're driving down, maybe you're on one right now, you're going to hit a rough patch when it comes to construction this season. And according to a new multi-year plan from the Illinois Department of Transportation, it's not going to change anytime soon. Along with funds from the federal government, the state will allocate more than $2 billion towards infrastructure projects like roads and bridges. And in addition to that, it's going to be shifting strategies from patchwork fixes to one of regular maintenance. The question is this too little, too late? Illinois Issues has been reporting on this. We're going to tweet out that link for those of you who are interested in this issue. But joining me now to talk about more about this is Joe Sweeterman, the director of the Chaddick Institute for the Metropolitan Development at DePaul University. Scott Sorrell is the administrator for Peoria County. Both of you, welcome back to the 21st.
Good afternoon.
Thanks, Dylan.
Kevin Burke's also on the line with us from Springfield. He's an executive vice president of the Illinois Asphalt Pavement Association. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for being with us as well.
Good morning.
Kevin, can I start by asking you about the money that's being allocated and this idea of regular maintenance as opposed to patchwork fixes? Is this, it sounds like a better solution.
It's definitely a better solution. And the department, when you look at the models that they ran compared to waiting till the pavement or the bridge falls apart and needs to be replaced compared to the moving towards the pavement preservation, their models show that there is significant improvement in the dollars are being spent better. The challenge with the program, and you alluded to it with the $2 billion number, that sounds like a big number. The problem is that's the same amount that we were spending back in the early 2000s on roads. So we're spending the same amount of money. We're going to get better results than waiting for the roads to fall apart, but we're still going to be falling behind, and we're going to see more roads in disrepair.
And so how far behind are we, Kevin? How much more money do you think we need to be investing in our roads?
That's a hard number to get to because, again, IDOT has a lot better resources to come up with that number. Same with the tollway. When you throw in the local agencies, which have over 120,000 miles of the roads in Illinois, that number becomes a little bit grayer. But in general, we would probably be talking for the department probably in the neighborhood of $6 to $7 billion extra over the next 5 to 10 year period just to get us to where we want to be. That's not included for system expansion or congestion relief or new starts.
And as we're thinking about this, Joe Sweeterman, I should mention to our audience, we did reach out to IDOT to join us with this conversation. They did not respond to us. Joe, when we're looking at historically and Illinois and investment in infrastructure, how would you rank us? How good of a job are we doing on this front?
Well, we're not as bad as you might think, given our state's notorious financial record. So people think naturally we'll be at the very bottom, and we actually have had some big capital bills, in the last 10 or 15 years that have sort of given us a little bit of catch up. But it's interesting how, so many things in life, the cost goes down. The cost of most products is declining. The cost of contracting lots of services is down. But when it comes to road construction, it seems like the dynamics have just made this more and more difficult. Things are rising faster than inflation. Now the price of oil is up again. And that raises cost. So suddenly we find ourselves falling, and we're falling pretty fast. We're still, about 60% of the roads, according to a report by the Illinois Economic Policy Institute, are around in good or fair condition. So it's not as if every road's falling apart, but boy, we are approaching a cliff, unfortunately.
Scott Sorrell's with us. He's a Peoria County Administrator. Scott, how does this come, when it comes to Peoria County, how much of funding do you rely on from the state versus the federal government? How does that work for you all?
So being a downstate county, our only direct influx of state dollars is through our allotment of motor fuel tax proceeds, which for us is about $2.5 million a year. We've got about a $6 million budget on an annual basis. Collar counties up in the Chicago area, they have the option for a local motor fuel tax. So do home rule municipalities across the state. And then there is always the asterisk behind that. For example, we do a major bridge project. That's normally going to have state funding. That's either federal dollars or state dollars that gets funneled through IDOT.
And so when there are problems with your roads, do you hear from folks in Peoria?
We do. We hear it quite a bit. In fact, we try to figure out a way to cobble together some local dollars to replace one of the busiest intersections here in the city of Peoria this summer that is jointly controlled by the county and the city. That's a $3 million project that we created a one-off solution for that that we really can't replicate going forward based on the types of revenues that county governments receive and the structure of county government. It just was a one-time solution for one intersection that's a $3 million cost of construction.
We've been talking about roads and infrastructure spending here on the 21st. Joe Sweeterman, returning to you and to Paul, one of the issues is, as we're hearing Scott talk about, is keeping transportation dollars for transport, keeping those dollars that are allocated for transportation, that it's actually going to that. I wanted to ask what happened to that. I think folks might be thinking right now about the ballot initiative a couple of years ago about roads. What happened with that?
You know, there's really two issues with gasoline tax going elsewhere. Some of it goes to transit and things like that. And then there's, of course, the general money that gets siphoned off for other purposes. And that's a bigger problem, really, at the federal level than it is at the state level. So right now we don't have a mandate that all gasoline taxes need to stay on the roads. And you want to be careful with that because, you know, our state, our bond rating isn't too good. Our rail system needs upgraded. We need to look at things as a system. So that's a difficult proposition. I think the bigger question is we just haven't, you know, it's funny, it's bipartisan now. It was five, 10 years ago, don't touch the gas tax. People are on a hair trigger, and you're going to be voted out of office if you raise the gas tax. Moods are softening on that. I think people see that, you know, our gas tax isn't adjusted for inflation. Price of fuel is relatively low still. You know, it's gone up.
Certainly not what it was a few years ago.
Right. And so I think probably the more logical step is to take, you know, the painful process of selling voters on a pretty significant tax increase on gas. It's probably the worst of the least of all evils right now.
Scott, do you think that voters, you mentioned some polling you've done in Peoria County. Does that sound like at least in Peoria, are people willing to pay more taxes?
You know, yet to be seen. We ran a local referendum to establish a sales tax specifically for roads in 2016, and that failed by 13 points. The county board here chose to put it on the ballot again this November. There's a vote yes private citizen group here that's done some polling that looks like it's a little bit more favorable, but still down. But you know, it's early in the campaigning process to see where that referendum is going to fall out in the fall.
It's a little bit more favorable, still down. Kevin, can I ask you what you think what drivers can expect in the next few years if things stay the way they are right now with the current funding situation in Illinois?
Yes. So what drivers are to expect, if you're on local routes, again, as Scott mentioned, they rely heavily, most local agencies downstate and upstate do rely heavily on the motor fuel tax funds. Those have been stagnant over the last 20 years, the local share. So you have in more rural counties, you have some that are looking at going from hard surface roads back to gravel. You're going to see less maintenance being done by local governments, so they're not going to be able to go out there and do the crack sealing, the oil and chipping that's going to preserve the roads and make them last longer. You won't see new starts. On the state road, there's federal mandates that come along with the federal dollars, of course, and so IDOT, in their transportation asset management plan, they have focused on the NHS routes or the National Highway System. So those routes, you're not going to see a difference in. So our interstate conditions.
Those are the big interstates then?
Those are the interstates, you know, the tollway and your major arterials around the interstates in more urban areas. Those roads will stay in relatively good condition. But what you're going to see is you're going to see the feeder routes and the rural routes, the state-marked routes and the unmarked state routes, they're going to fall in condition significantly. In the 10-year plan that IDOT released, they anticipate their state-marked routes, they want to be at about 70-75% in good or acceptable, what they would call acceptable condition. They're forecasting that it's going to be around 30% of the roads are going to be in in good con- or in it meet their criteria of being in acceptable condition. So the motorists, when you think about that, if you're not on the interstate, you're going to see very rough roads, which is going to lead to more damage to your vehicle, more fuel usage and mileage.
And
I just had to replace
not
my
a great situation, it sounds like.
$150.
I'm sure. So. Thanks. Yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thanks for that. That's Kevin Burke with the Illinois Asphalt Pavement Association in Springfield. Just Sweeterman Smith with us for DePaul from DePaul University, and Scott Sorrell with Peoria County. As I mentioned, our friends at Illinois Issues have been reporting on this. We'll tweet out all of that information. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In recent years, researchers have been learning more about how the stress of being a minority has real consequences, not just for mental and physical health. We've seen that, especially we've had conversations here on The 21st about what that means for African Americans. Well, there's a new study from Northwestern University that shows that lesbian, bisexual, and questioning individuals face higher risks for not just obesity, but type 2 diabetes. And that risk of developing those diseases can start when you're teenagers. Lauren Beach is a postdoctoral research fellow at Northwestern's Institute for Gender and Minority Health and Well-Being. She joins us from our studios on their Evanston campus. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks so much. Good morning. It's a pleasure to join you today.
Lauren, I wonder if we can just start with the key highlights from this study that you all did.
Yeah, sure. So the study, which was recently published in the journal Pediatric Diabetes, we found that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and questioning high school-aged youth are at higher risk for type 2 diabetes due to three factors. The first, which you already mentioned, was higher rates of obesity among sexual minority female and sexual minority and questioning female students, The second was lower levels of physical activity across the board among both male and female sexual minority and questioning youth. And the third was higher levels of sedentary behavior. And again, that was significant among female sexual minority and questioning students.
So do we know what accounts for that higher risk, particularly when we're talking about physical activity?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So the study found that there are, again, lower levels of physical activity, but we weren't able to explain what caused it using the variables in the study. So one thing that we did look at, though, that was in the study was whether or not people were more likely or less likely to attend gym class. And we didn't find differences in that except for among gay male youth. And so what else is causing that, I think, is open to investigation and something that we're definitely interested in looking more into in the future.
I think people might be interested in this Institute for Gender and Minority Health and Well-Being and just this whole field of research that I think has happened more lately about the links between being a minority and the effect it can have not just on your mental health, but your physical health. How do you think this research adds to that conversation?
Yeah, thanks. So as a postdoctoral fellow in the Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, it's been a real delight for me in terms of being able to go in depth into asking questions exactly like you just posed. I would say that this study, first of all, adds to the literature about what leads to worse physical health outcomes among minority individuals, in that it's specifically looking among adolescents and high school-aged youth. And that is a rarity among these studies. I think it's also unique in that it's thinking that we're looking at diabetes risk in sexual and gender minority populations, which has really not been done before, especially in this young of a group.
And do you think the diabetes risk comes from the weight? Do you think it's related to obesity, or is there something else at work here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the reason why we looked at obesity, physical activity, and sedentary behavior is they're all identified as risk factors for diabetes within the American Diabetes Association's guidelines. And those are some factors that are listed, but there are also many other factors that affect it. So thinking specifically about neighborhood safety, about whether or not youth might have parks nearby, if they have a high school, if they're attending a high school that has gym class, like we mentioned earlier, and also whether or not they live in a food desert. There are many factors that could affect risk for diabetes, but we just were able to study the ones that were included that were named by the American Diabetes Association within the YRBS data set.
So what are the biggest questions you have now after this initial study?
Yeah, I think we really want to know more about why. So we, as I said, we did this initial work within the Youth Risk Behavioral Surveillance data set, or YRBS, that's put out by the CDC every year. But I think we would want to look more, maybe doing recruiting people, doing a cohort study, or we would want to talk to youth who are living with diabetes or who might fall into some of these categories in terms of having lower physical activity or higher sedentary behavior, and ask them why and what's it like to live their lives, and how might their identities that they have affect their answers.
And Lauren, what do you think implications are for the medical community? How do you want doctors to be thinking about this issue now that at least you have this initial research published?
I would encourage doctors to think about thoughtful ways and to attend trainings to ask their patients, even their adolescent patients, about sexual orientation, gender identity. And that is really important because one of the implications of this study and some others that I've done within looking at these diabetes within adults, sexual minorities, is that we might be wanting to screen sexual and gender minority individuals sooner in life for diabetes and diabetes risk factors. And the only way that doctors can do that is if they ask the questions to identify their patients.
Are doctors doing that now?
So there's some research about that, and I think what a lot of it shows is largely they are not, especially not among these younger populations. That what happens is doctors think that patients should tell them, and patients think doctors should ask them, so the conversations are often missed.
Mm. And I wanted to ask you also just your thoughts on this. I know this is your initial research, but I think people who are just sort of connecting the dots here logically might think about the fact that you're talking about lack of activity or obesity. I wonder if when we're talking particularly about youth who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or questioning, is it someone perhaps that there might be they might find maybe more community on the internet or play more video games instead of maybe playing sports with peers where they might feel ostracized? Do you think that might be part of what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you are LGB or Q, you're often not born into a family that's like yourself. And so you have to look elsewhere to find community. And when you go out into your daily life in your community, most people aren't going to be like you either in that way. So yes, I think the easiest thing to do now is to go on the internet to try to find supportive places and forums and groups to find and build community. And oftentimes, I think that's in video games. I think it's on Facebook or it's in other social media sites.
Lauren, one last question for you. We've talked about doctors. We've talked about the medical community. What do you think adults in these young people's lives should be thinking about given this initial research?
I think that adults should be considering ways that they can indicate they're affirming and supportive of LGBTQ youth who are in their lives, and that may mean making supportive statements, you know, because people around, these are invisible identities often until people are coming out of the closet. And so adults should be indicating their support and affirmation for youth so that they know it's safe to come out to them and that they can help build in real life supportive communities and not just those on the internet.
That's Lauren Beach, a postdoctoral fellow at Northwestern University with its Institute for Gender and Minority Health and Well-Being on some new research that's just been published. We will have more details on that at our website and tweet it out as well for those of you who are more interested. Lauren, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nyla, for the opportunity, and have a great day.
A few years ago, I switched to checking out digital library books because I never remember to return actual books and the fines pile up. But now one library in Illinois is changing that. Actually, my home library, the Champaign Public Library, this week announced it's moving towards automatic renewals. So does this mean the end of fines for at least patrons of the Champaign Public Library? Deputy Director Brittany Michaels is in studio with me now to explain why this move was made. It's not the first in Illinois. Hi, Brittany. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
So is this the end of library fines for overdue books?
Not entirely. So up to this point, our customers have had the opportunity to renew items on eligible items And many can renew those either through the app or on the website or by giving us a phone call. So what we've really done is to help ease this process and enhance the service by making it automatic. So there are items, of course, that are not eligible for renewal, things that have holds, ILL items, e-content, hourly items, Chromebooks, hotspots, that kind of thing. So we won't see an entire elimination of overdue fines and fees, but it is a great service to help enhance what we currently offer.
And why did you all do this? Was it based on what the behavior was of what you were already seeing with your patrons?
Well, in part, I think, you know, a lot of libraries across the nation and, of course, throughout the state are offering this service. And, you know, we've heard a lot of feedback from our community and, you know, even just the general perception of how people interact with the library. Our goal is to encourage a great experience, encourage great service and convenience. And we really want to reduce those barriers that anyone might feel about anxiety for returning materials. Families are busy. Individuals are busy. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of people say things like, oh, we may not be able to check out materials right now, or, oh, we're worried about the overdue fines and fees. And this is just a great way to help ease some of that.
So do you all collect a lot of money from fines, or was dropping that not a big financial issue for you all?
Well, over the past few years, we've had good budget news, and we have seen the revenues coming back from fines and fees and things like overdues, which make up a portion of fines and fees, reduce. So it's something that we've been conscientious about. It's kind of a gradual change. Again, we're not completely eliminating a revenue stream, but we are sort of easing into this conversation that a lot of libraries are having, which is how do we reduce some of those barriers, and in particular, financial barriers.
We're talking to Brittany Michaels. She's the deputy director of the Champaign Public Library. They just announced this week they're moving to automatic renewals. And as you mentioned, Brittany, you're not the first to do this. There are places across the country. Here in Illinois, Oak Park, a suburb of Chicago, is one place that also has automatic renewals. It sounds like it's a little bit of a philosophical shift that some libraries are making. What, and you, to you, does it represent really the idea of making the library a place where you can get as many people as possible coming, and you want to remove as many barriers as possible to people using your services?
Oh, absolutely. Accessibility is a huge part of this. So philosophically, absolutely, we want more people using the library. And in fact, a lot of these communities who have implemented automatic renewals have seen that more people are using their library because of this. You know, it reduces that financial barrier, albeit a small one for some families. For others, it has a huge impact. So by doing this, you know, we really are hopeful that we'll encourage more use from families.
And how will this work? So there's not, it's not going to automatically keep renewing and keep renewing. You do have a limit on this, right?
Well, we do up to an extent. So items that are eligible for renewal can renew up to 10 times so long as they remain eligible. But like we talked about, there are a couple of items that we have that are not eligible for renewal. And so our customers currently receive a notification 3 days before items are due back. The beautiful part is that it will tell you whether your item's been renewed or whether you still need to return it.
And are you seeing that a lot of people are using the technology that you all have available to you, the app, doing things online via email, as opposed to just coming into the library and saying, I need to renew this book?
Well, that's a really good question because, yes, I mean, we see a lot of that in terms of renewing items. You know, we'll get a lot of phone calls. We also see people kind of managing that themselves through technology. But this is another great advancement in technology that we can just do for them. But, you know, it is interesting because we're seeing a lot of people, you know, check out digital content using our resources and services online. And then they're almost coming into the library for more of that social connection, more of that interaction with the rest of the community. So it's really exciting to see the different trends in usage.
When you mention the interaction in the social community, I wonder, it's summer, school's out, what kind of activities you're doing at the Champaign Public Library over the rest of the summer that people should know about?
Well, we have a lot coming up. And of course, we've been doing our annual summer reading program. Our theme is Power Up. So we've had a lot of really great events. We're going to have, of course, our food truck rally coming up on August 8th. So we'll have lots of great food available. We'll have face painting. We'll have balloons. We'll have music. And so just a lot of really fun activities for families to enjoy throughout the rest of the summer.
So those are for folks in the central Illinois area. Those activities will be available for them at the Champaign Public Library. Again, their news they announced this week, moving to automatic renewals, part of a trend, it seems, across the state and the country. Brittany, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
We'll be right back. That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, President Trump is visiting Illinois for the first time since taking office. He's going to be in Granite City. Tomorrow, we're going to be hearing from community members in that southwestern part of the state, including the vice president of the local steelworkers union. We'll also be talking to activists who've planned protests, and we want to hear from you how you feel about it. If you want to give us a call, or you could always give us a call and let us know how you're feeling about it. Our hotline number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. How are you feeling about President Trump making his first visit to Illinois tomorrow? By the way, if you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. You can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple to download. You set your home station, and you can search for The 21st to follow us. It's an easy way to listen to past shows. You can also find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background of what we're talking about. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stShow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Penlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.